Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
So thanks to everyone for being seated, and while everyone's quiet, I'll start proceedings briefly. Many thanks to the Sydney Institute's, I'm Gerard Henderson, the Executive Director of the Sydney Institute. Many thanks to the Sydney Institute's corporate supporters and members and their guests for coming along tonight. And before handing over to Nick Johnson, who will be our MC for this evening, I would like to make a few brief comments. As many of you know, many of you have been here before, the Sydney Institute's annual dinner lecture is a private dinner followed by a public address followed by a private dinner. And the media is welcome to film the Governor-General's address, but the remainder of the night is for a private function, and it would be appreciated if camera crew and photographers did not walk among the tables. Thanks again to Australia Post for sponsoring this function. It's always great to work with my friend Stephen Walter from Australia Post on this sponsorship, and Stephen reminded me tonight that this is the ninth occasion on which Australia Post has sponsored this. So thanks for that. I'd like to formally welcome Australia Post Chairman David Mortimer, who's seated on the main table at table 31. This year, on the occasion of the bicentenary of Australia Post, and the signs are here, Australia Post has provided for all guests its bicentenary first day cover, which includes Australia Post 200 years stamp, along with a $1 uncirculated coin. And it's a great collection. It's on your tables and a suitable reminder of tonight's dinner. So thanks again to Australia Post, and congratulations to Australia Post on the occasion of its bicentenary. Thanks also to George Malteborough and Energy Australia for making possible the audio-visual coverage of the Governor General's address for all of us here tonight. And thanks to Vintage Blue Wines for its assistance in providing tonight's wines, and to Coca-Cola Amatil for providing the soft drinks. Thanks also to Staging Connections, who are great to work with, doing all the audio-visual work tonight, and to Star City, who are also always great to work with at our annual dinner. And now it's over to Nicholas Johnson, the Chairman of the Sydney Institute and the Chief Executive of Barclays Capital Australia, who will be MC for tonight's event. Thank you.
Well, having hectored everybody earlier on to sit down, it's not really a novelty now to start off, but let me say again, welcome to the 2009 Annual Dinner of the Sydney Institute. On behalf of my fellow directors of the Institute, I extend a special welcome to our guest speaker, the Governor-General, Her Excellency Quentin Bryce and Mr. Michael Bryce. Before I run through the logistics for the evening, I'd like also to note that this year marks the 20th anniversary of the Sydney Institute's establishment. In retrospect, 1989 was a huge crowded year in the world, which started with the burning of copies of the Satanic Verses and subsequent fatwa on Salman Rushdie, then the final withdrawal of Russian troops from Afghanistan, the death of the Ayatollah Khomeini, tanks in Tiananmen Square, and ended with the fall of the Berlin Wall. And it wasn't much quieter in Australia, with John Howard being deposed as leader of the Liberal Party, so things don't change. The Queensland National Party losing power after 32 years in office, Bond Corporation going broke, an earthquake hitting Newcastle, and Australia winning the Ashes in England for the first time in 40 years. It was a packed year indeed, so a great achievement to Gerard and Anne Henderson to have managed the birth of the Sydney Institute amid such distractions. So well done, Gerard and Anne. On the other hand, that crowded year perhaps provided just the right climate in which to launch a public affairs forum intent on delivering around 60 public events each year, plus many private dinners. And that's exactly what Gerard and Anne with their team have delivered through an extraordinary series of talks and debates covering many, many aspects of Australian life and current events. While the centre of the Institute's focus remains Australian politics and history, it's hard not to be impressed by a curriculum That has included talks by modern-day explorers from the Northern Territory to West Australia, accounts of white Russians and one Australian fighting for Franco in the Spanish Civil War, plus much on major global themes like climate change and the financial crisis. Papers from these public forums, and including tonight's lecture, are published in the Institute's publication, The Sydney Papers, and are available as podcasts. And for its corporate supporters, there have been, over the past year alone, private dinners with everyone sitting around one table, with Juliet Gillard, Wayne Swan, Malcolm Turnbull, Anthony Albanese, Julie Bishop, Chris Bowen, Simon Crean, Maxine McHugh, with more to come, including Colin Barnett this week. While the Institute's proven business formula will continue into the next 20 years, we do anticipate some selective expansion in activities. And one I'll mention now is the intention to encourage a series of occasional lectures under the banner of the Jim and Jeanette Bain Lectures. Jim and Jeanette were the Institute's inaugural donors and have been among the Institute's strongest and longest supporters. And this association is a fitting acknowledgement of their enthusiasm and commitment. The first of these events is planned for early February next year, with the speaker being the celebrated English historian, Michael Burley. With that background, let me, on behalf of my fellow directors, congratulate and thank Gerard and Anne, plus all their colleagues, especially Lolita Mathias, for the past 20 years, all the individual members and the corporate members who support the Institute, and not least all the speakers who have so generously contributed to the valuable public debates for the past two decades. And that list includes Quentin Bryce herself, who addressed the Institute in June 1994. Returning to the practicalities of tonight, we'll immediately serve entree, followed by the main course. At 9:10, I'll invite Nick Greiner, well known to all of you, to introduce Quentin Bryce. Nick Greiner, when Premier of New South Wales, opened the Sydney Institute's office at 41 Phillip Street on the 23rd of August 1989. Quentin Bryce's talk will conclude around 9:45. Bob Carr, also a former Premier of New South Wales, will thank our speaker at the conclusion of the lecture. Bob Carr also spoke at the Institute's opening two decades ago when he was opposition leader. Dessert will follow and dinner will formally conclude at around 10:30. And you're, of course, welcome to stay on for conversation. As in previous years, you're welcome to move around the room between courses. Dinner for over 700 people is a big practical challenge, and the board would like to thank tonight the Sydney Institute staff who organised the event, specifically Deputy Director Anne Henderson and Lolita Mathias, with able support from the Institute's young part-timers, Viren Nathu, Giselle Kenny, Anya Puchansky, and Rafi Gold. And of course, the board's thanks to all the Institute's corporate supporters and associate members, many of whom are here tonight. Board members tonight include Paul Murnane, Carolyn Kay, Lynn Ralph, Carol Schwartz, and Craig Shapiro. In conclusion, I'd like to present to the Governor-General this presentation box and plaque, which commemorates Australia Post bicentenary. It contains a set of five reissued stamps, which were judged to be Australia's most popular stamps, along with a silver ingot of the 1913 Kangaroo and Map stamp, which was judged to be the most popular. It is only fitting that the Governor-General receives her gift first, and this I'm about to do at table number 31. Now, please enjoy the lecture, the evening and the lecture, and I look forward to welcoming Quentin Bryce to the stand at around 10 past 9. Thank you.
Before I hand over to Nick Greiner, which I'm going to do in a minute, I would say that the proceedings are being filmed this evening by Foxtel. It's on channel 607 on Sky, so thanks very much to the TV coverage. There you go. Thank you. Look, I'm going to hand over to Nick Greiner. Nick Greiner really needs no introduction as an ex-premier of the state, and he will introduce the Governor-General. So, Nick, thank you.
Your Excellency and friends of the Sydney Institute all. When I cut the ribbon, I don't know that there was one, but when I cut the metaphorical ribbon to launch the Sydney Institute, it was 20 years ago last week, and Bob Carr, who was then the opposition leader, was there as part of the launch. Nobody would have guessed the depth of the contribution that the Sydney Institute would make to open debate, not only in this city, but in this country. I think the hope and the expectation was that the new institute would become an integral part of making Sydney a really fully fledged global city, one that was comfortable with and perhaps accessible to a great variety of ideas, ideas that were sometimes controversial, sometimes conflicting, but really that the Institute would be part of making Sydney a showcase for tolerance and for diversity. I think after 20 years looking back, we could say with great confidence that the Institute has lived up to those rather lofty aspirations. I took the trouble to look up the speeches that had been made this year, the major speeches, there are a lot more events that had been made in the first 8 or 9 months of this year. In reverse order from the present, what's happening to retail? Energy policy for Australia? What's right? Liberalism and conservatism. The triumph of trade liberalisation over protectionism. A look at Pakistan and Iran. Searching for the lost mother, the painting and the person. The internet, Australia's role and opportunities. Creatures of the Liberal Party. I missed that one. A progress report on the National Human Rights Consultation. Australian banks, sinners or saints. Climate change, two views. Reflections on the global financial crisis, Arab culture and modernity, and last but not least, especially given the headlines of today, the politics of desire. I think it's fair to say, ladies and gentlemen, that Gerard and Anne Henderson have led the Institute with vision and with rigour, and perhaps more importantly, with that indefinable intellectual energy that captures fresh thought and leading moments in a society. Now, I think we've got one of those moments tonight, for it is the first time in the Sydney Institute's history that a Governor-General is to address its guests, and it is, of course, the first time in our country's history that a woman has taken the oaths of allegiance and office in the Senate chamber and entered the driver's seat at Yarralumla. Her Excellency, Quentin Bryce AC, is Australia's 25th Governor-General. I'm minded to point out, I think there have been 41 Prime Ministers. I'm not quite sure what it says about job security and other things. Quentin is a former Governor of Queensland, Principal and CEO of the Women's College at the University of Sydney, Founding Chair and CEO of the National Childcare Accreditation Council, Federal Sex Discrimination Commissioner, Inaugural Director of the Queensland Women's Information Service and the Office of the Status of Women, Convener of the National Women's Advisory Council, and a legal academic. And that's really only a small handful of her roles in over 40 years of outstanding public and professional service. And many of those roles have been genuine firsts in groundbreaking territory. In 2003, the Sydney Morning Herald asked 50 prominent Australians, I wasn't one of them, what qualities are required of a Governor-General? Some offered a choice of names of people they thought would be okay. Some, of course, queried the fundamental purpose and value of the role. Now, without attributing responses here, this is what some of them said about those essential qualities. Humanity, humility, a liberal intellect, and a nice person. They must understand and empathise with Australians from all walks of life. Someone of clear integrity and experience in public life. Someone above politics, non-partisan. The job needs tact, patience, and restraint in private, and prestige in public. And a woman. It's about time. Now, that's the end of the selection from what people suggested to the Herald. I would have thought that many of us here tonight would agree that Quentin Bryce is eminently well suited for the task for which he is now charged. It's no secret that I'm a strong believer in the merits of Australia becoming a republic. I was a forthright proponent within the Liberal Party and to the broader coalition. I served on Mr. Keating's advisory committee on the Republic in 1993 and made my views clearly known in a speech to the Sydney Institute in October of that year, a couple of weeks after the committee released its report. I concluded by saying that a republic, quote, will simply be the final evolutionary step in Australia having an entirely Australian system of government, as we most assuredly should, unquote. Now, of course, after much widespread proselytising across party lines throughout the decade of the 90s, there was a failed referendum in 1999, and the Republican debate has since lost momentum, despite perhaps an expectation among some in the community that the election of the Labor government in late 2007 would see it return to the political agenda. I suspect it most assuredly will return in the next few terms of federal parliament, regardless of election results. But meanwhile, and politics well aside, these are interesting and challenging times to be occupying the office of Governor-General. The role and its incumbent attract a deal of scrutiny in the media, I suspect more than ever before. And that, of course, in turn fuels the voracious blogging public. How does one contemporise a traditional role, a role that has a largely ceremonial and community focus, while at the same time ensuring that constitutional conventions and reserve powers are strictly observed and judiciously executed? I think each time a Governor-General is appointed, we should ask this question afresh, as the answer depends very much on the individual. Indeed, I'm sure many of you will have a question like that on your lips this evening. Now, ladies and gentlemen, this coming Saturday will mark the anniversary of Her Excellency's first year in office. As we've seen in the press over the last 12 months, and indeed as you could read in Gerard Nan's invitation, it has been an extraordinarily busy year for our Governor-General. Everyone wants to know more about this girl from country Queensland, a lawyer, a human rights advocate, a feminist, a senior public officer, a mother of five, grandmother of six. What makes her tick? What drives her? And what does she bring to this complex and ever-evolving role? Ladies and gentlemen, it's my sincere pleasure to introduce the Governor-General of Australia, Quentin Bryce.
The Honourable Nick Greiner, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your very warm welcome. I'm glad it was about blogging and not flogging. Gerard and Anne, thank you for your generous invitation to me this evening. I have known both our hosts for many years now, and it's reassuring to me that they are still doing what they're doing, leading and running the Sydney Institute. An important gatherer of people and ideas, an agent for discussion about the things we care about, a forum for thinking aloud, and a chance to catch up with friends and colleagues at the end of long working days. There's no doubt that part of its enduring success and following is due to the fact that one declines an invitation from Gerard Henderson only at one's peril. Always better to turn up, I think, hear what he has to say about you, and hopefully steer him off the worst of it. One of the things I've always done is write letters, the old-fashioned way. Growing up in the bush, it's what we all did. I've never shaken the habit, nor ever wanted to. For the past few years, people from all over Queensland, and now the whole country, pen me notes about what's going on in their lives, what they want me to pay attention to, and what they don't much like about me. I feel privileged to receive these letters and grateful that we live in a society that fosters such an easy and honest exchange. Every so often, an exchange continues beyond a letter here and back. There's one that started in September last year and is still going. A farming couple from the Victorian Goldfields region wrote to me the morning after they'd seen me in an interview with Kerry O'Brien on the 7:30 report. At the start of the interview, Norman remarks to Muriel, "I don't think she's going to be our sort of person." Muriel agrees. Nevertheless, they take a quick look and then decide to sit it out. Their commentary on my answers is warm and intelligent, sincere and direct. In the end, with relief, I get through. "Must be your country upbringing," they conclude. Ladies and gentlemen, I want to tell you a little bit about where I've come from to help explain where I've been, what I've done, and who I've met during my first 12 months in office. I've met people going through real trauma, as individuals and as communities. And if there's one word I'll keep coming back to tonight, it will be the word tough. We are tough people. In my early years, I lived with my mother and father and three sisters at Ilfracombe in central western Queensland. It was a town of 300 people in a shire of only 100 more, 800 kilometres west of Rockhampton, between Barcaldine and Longreach. Ilfracombe is at the heart of sheep and cattle grazing country. And back then, in the 40s and 50s, the land grew some of the best wool in the world. It was hot and stark and, on the whole, brown. Not the red brown of rich farming soil. The earth was a dusty, washed out brown, and the Mitchell grass stumps were the colour of milky coffee. And those flies, they just hung around in their thousands. And that was it. The goats chewed out the scrub, and you couldn't grow trees or gardens, though my mother made a great fist of it every year. The bull water was terrific for scouring wool, but it was toxic and killed just about any form of plant life. There was, until the early 50s, no sewerage, no electricity, and no reticulated water. There was very little opportunity for travel apart from the odd footy match in Longreach. And it wasn't uncommon to have several generations living in the one house. It was a close-knit community. People had enormous respect for one another. They were tough, yet considerate and well-mannered. They supported each other through rain and drought. Friendship was based on what you gave, not what you earned. And despite the blight occasioned by two world wars and a depression, they shared a resolve to make life better for their kids. There was an almost defiant sense of hope. My father managed the local wool scour. It was the town's biggest employer. Everyone wanted to share in the pride of producing what was then Australia's most lucrative export. My dad took his responsibilities very seriously. He loved the wool industry and he loved people. For someone who had a sign above his door that read, "Be brief, be businesslike, be bold," he was the greatest yarner I've ever known. There was a kernel of a message always about honour, about courage, or taking yourself too seriously, or remembering who your friends are. If I can say my dad ran the scour, my mother ran the home. a traditional marriage in that sense, but in fact they were equal partners in what was very much a joint venture. They were no different from all the other parents we knew, totally dedicated to their children. But fuss and fawn, they did not. My mother was passionate about education and fiercely resolute that her girls would derive its benefits. And we were expected to be involved in things beyond ourselves. I can say with certainty that my parents influenced my own mothering and led me to the range of advocacy and rights work I've done over the last 40 years. And in a way, perhaps, they brought me to this role. One of the most enjoyable things I do at Government House and when I travel around Australia is talk with children. I tell them about our parliamentary democracy, and I often do that as I'm walking into an executive council meeting next door. They tell me about their schools, their teachers, their families, their potty calves, their dogs and cats and snakes, and their dreams. And I carry their stories with me from school to school, city to bush, bush to city. And to those from small, rural and remote communities who wonder what they might be missing out on in the city, I tell them about Ilfracombe. And I say, cherish your country childhood. It will stand you in great stead all your life. You will see sterling examples of friendship, kindness, adaptability, patience, courage and hard work. And you will learn how to be tough when you need to be. You will always know who you are. When I took my oath of office in the Senate chamber nearly a year ago, surrounded by loved ones, colleagues and prominent Australians, the girl from Ilfracombe couldn't quite believe she was the country's 25th Governor General. But she knew too that that dusty little town had played a big part in her getting there. On that same day, my elder sister Diane pulled me aside and looked me dead in the eye. She said to me, "You remember who you are." In the last 12 months, her words have stayed with me. They have reminded me of the sum of what I am and to give the very best of it. They have urged me to think about what I can give now in a new role, not what I have given before in different roles. And they've put me in a quieter place where opening my eyes and ears, my heart and mind, is often the most useful thing I can do. This role affords the privilege of seeing from a position that offers a vast and truthful lens. It allows me to take in our social fabric, the gauze stretched around and between our institutions, our laws, our economy, and our democratic structures. I meet a lot of remarkable people. They touch my life. They stir my conscience. They invite me to take a small step into a broader landscape. I have seen in my first year of office that as Australians, we are united beyond our differences and individual pursuits. We pause to speak and listen to each other, to build fair and inclusive communities, and to restore broken ones. In East Timor, where I was only 48 hours ago, for a second visit in the last year, men and women of the ADF and the AFP carry on to keep the streets and homes secure and to engage an ever younger population that is either out of work or out of school. In the central highlands of Afghanistan, a tough, volatile and dangerous place, our soldiers resist the insurgency and help the Afghani people rebuild their lives and their land, teaching them trades, making bricks, building bridges, laying concrete, helping them get jobs, and starting all this with basic maths classes. There's something distinctly Australian about how they do it. They are superbly trained professionals with top-class skills, but they also lead and teach, mentor and play, and live together with a special warmth, modesty and unfailing good humour. Bedding down in a concrete bunker for the night in Tarrancout, it was my own tough luck that I missed the sign about chicks and blokes time for the toilets and showers. And no one is spared a dig in the ribs, including the granny in the pink dress, who just happens to be their new commander-in-chief. When you try to thank them for all that they do, they brush it off with the typical, "It's my job." It's what Trooper Donaldson said after I pinned our country's highest award for courage to his lapel. It's what the young soldier who had his legs blown off in a bomb explosion said to me. It's what they all say, and it's what their parents and family say. What it means is, it's what I expect to have to do. I want to do it, and I want to get back to it. I had lunch with Trooper Donaldson and his SAS mates. They all joked and rubbished each other as if they'd been on a holiday camp. And then I asked them about their injuries. A trouser leg is absently pulled up, and I'm reminded of the terror of their working days. Each year we wrestle with words to describe the Anzac spirit. I don't think we ever do it the justice it deserves. But we share a sense of it, and we've held on to it since it emerged in World War I. In my visits to Dili and Tarrancout, Singapore and Malta, to Australian graves and memorials in the weeping battlefields of France and Tanzania's Dar es Salaam, Australians are spoken of with great fondness and true admiration. Of course, it's not only in conflict that Australians shine, but there is a toughness about us that equips us for adversity. The weather alone delivers our fair share of it. This year, it was the devastating bushfires in Victoria and the floods in North Queensland. For years and years, huge swathes of the country have been desiccated by severe drought. Livelihoods and whole communities through the Murray-Darling Basin have been imperiled by the workings of drought, fire, flood, acid mud and human action over many decades. In the rescues and the clean-ups and the long hauls, I see the same attitude over and over again. People just rally and get on with it. I watch the people of Innisfail who'd lost the contents of their houses to the floodwall pick up their Centrelink checks on one side of the street, walk over to the other and give them to the bushfire appeal. There are tears and grief and frustration, but with that, an overflowing generosity and no fuss. It's not the style and stoicism, though, that I remember of my parents' generation. People are counselled and encouraged now to talk about their losses in constructive ways that help them to re-establish their lives and their communities. This quality of Australian toughness that I keep coming back to, what I saw as a child in Ilfracombe, what is still there today and embedded throughout our country, it's not an end in itself. It not only ensures that we cope, it also produces results, achievements, solutions to complex problems. We see it in our groundbreaking farming techniques. We see it in our management of natural disasters. We see it in our water technologies and climate expertise. We see it in our peacekeeping and humanitarian operations. And we see it in our volunteers here and abroad. I was privileged when I went to Africa this year to meet with obstetrician Dr. Catherine Hamlin, an Australian who has lived and worked in Ethiopia for 50 years. She and her husband arrived in 1959, intending a three-year shift, long enough to set up a midwifery school. They were so appalled by women's suffering from fistula caused by prolonged and obstructed childbirth that they stayed on. They developed a surgical technique to repair the fistulae, and in 1974 they opened the Addis Ababa Fistula Hospital, which has treated more than 30,000 women. Dr. Hamlin turned 85 this year and she's still doing surgery. I sat with her in her lovely garden alongside the hospital. I tried to explore with her her contribution of over half a century. She flicked my knee and said, "Oh, you don't want to hear about all that." She was happy to chatter on for ages, as long as it wasn't about herself. There is something about being a woman in this role. It's not about doing it better, only differently. When women get together, particularly older women like me, the icebreakers are usually our grandchildren. Whether I'm talking with Sudanese women in Adelaide, women out the back of Bourke or in the heart of Sydney, elders in Manangreda, or with Dr. Hamlin, Her Majesty the Queen, or with the first female Prime Minister of Mozambique. Family is where we begin. Then on to business. It's often been said that the face of poverty is a woman. What I have learned is that the face of the future leadership of Africa is also a woman. In my meetings with senior African women in government, development, and the judiciary, we focused on maternal mortality, childhood malnutrition, the special needs of the girl child, the toll of HIV/AIDS, and the role of the Global Fund. The importance of women in leadership is, of course, universal. Recently, I visited several bush communities in the Northern Territory. The Aboriginal women leaders of Papunya, the Papunya artists, performed a dance for me, the honey ant dance. They'd never done it for anyone else. They honoured me with a ceremonial stick that signifies the story of the land. I keep it in my office to remind me of the privilege of this role and my responsibility to be a Governor General for all Australians. Afterwards, we sat together on the ground and ate lunch. As always, we talked about our grandchildren, about women and health, breastfeeding, schooling, and the quality of opportunity in Papunya. Recalling how the women spoke with such affection for their community and dedication to their art, how I stood in their art centre and looked out to the splendour of the landscape, I can only say, I wish you could have been there. In fact, I say that to Australians wherever I go, about wherever I've been, because there's nothing like seeing it for yourself, and I could never hope to tell all the stories. The thing we often forget to talk about, or perhaps we take for granted, is our country's dazzling beauty. Our natural environment is so much a part of Australia's art, writing, music and culture, both Indigenous and non-Indigenous. The collections of our regional, city and national galleries, museums and libraries are testament to the depth of our historical and contemporary talent. To have an Emily Kingwarre hanging on a Yarralumla wall, a Margaret Olley in the entrance to my office, a William Robinson close behind me as I correspond with my pen pals, David Maloof's ransom, Kate Grenville's lieutenant on the table nearby. I feel immensely fortunate and proud to be an Australian. We must look after what we have. When I visit inland and remote towns, I often stop by at the aged care centre. Some of those tiny places do it so well. There might be a kindergarten, a school and a nursing home, all within cooee of one another, and all connected and involved with the wider community. The kids see their grandparents and great aunts and uncles on their way home from school. They share afternoon tea, sing to them, read books on their beds, and push their chairs in the gardens. Aging ought to be seen as a natural part of life. There's no doubt that it presents challenges, most of them randomly dished out to us. How we care for our growing elderly population, whatever extra burdens they might bear in their later years, is a manifest sign of the health, well-being, and humanity of our whole nation. Ladies and gentlemen, I've come to this role on the shoulders of 24 others who've come before me. The way they went about their duties, their speeches, their experiences and responses make up an important manual for me. When I was leaving Queensland, in anticipation, I quoted Sir Zelman Cowan as if to steel myself. He said that the role intellectually stretched him. His knowledge, experience, and capacity were constantly called on and tested. Of course, he was right, and I know only a drop of it. But I have the greatest faith in my teachers, Australians of every imaginable walk. I was out at the Windora Ball a few years ago. Windora is in Queensland's Channel Country, where the great red gums stretch out over the mighty Cooper. The real outback. It's a few hundred K west of Longreach and then south. It was Windora's 125th anniversary. I wandered out the back to where the bar was to have a look around. I ran into a tall, skinny bushy in a nostalgic grey suit he'd probably worn 20 years earlier and a 10-gallon hat to match. It was quiet. I said to him, "Like your hat?" He said, "You reckon?" Quiet again. Then he said to me, "Listen, love, why don't you pour yourself a couple of rums and settle down?" Ladies and gentlemen, thank you and have a wonderful evening.
Her Excellency Governor-General Quentin Bryce and Michael Bryce, friends of the Sydney Institute, ladies and gentlemen. Look, I'm sorry to have been late. I went to another engagement and had that problem of explaining why I was in a dinner suit and everyone else was in casual gear. I explained that since the global financial crisis hit last September, things had been pretty tough, and I do three nights a week serving drinks in the Texas Tavern. And it seemed to be accepted readily, and I think we'll snake back to all of you as a bit of Sydney urban myth. Jared, it was very cruel of you to project images of everyone as they were 20 years ago on the screen, almost as if you were provoking Richard II's response, "Call back yesterday, bid time return." The Governor-General called back yesterday in her beautiful and eloquent address. The yesterday of those, what I think all of us would refer to as the old Australians, the Australians who encompassed World War I, the Depression, World War II, the post-war reconstruction, within their life's experience. The adults she grew up with in rural Queensland. But to me, she went beyond nostalgia because she drew a link between the finest qualities of that generation, the people we are all so fond of, also indebted to, and the Australians she's met as volunteers, as service people in Afghanistan, nation builders in Timor, health professionals in Africa, working for Australia, working for humanity. I think we all share her admiration and her fondness for Australians of that generation. But we appreciate the link she draws between them and the younger Australians, part of this globalised world. Like you, I think you'll agree with me that I like the notion of the Governor-General of this country as the nation's storyteller. Someone familiar with the treasure trove in our libraries, our great museums, our art collections, and proud of the works of Australian authors. Someone who knows this country and knows its landscapes and loves them, can talk fondly of the River Redgums, for example. I've got a notion that the simplest way for us, through the argument about a republic, elected head of state, appointed head of state, president, nomenclature, Federal Republic of Australia or whatever, is a simple, an elegantly simple amendment to our Constitution that simply says the Governor-General shall be the nation's head of state. And I think with the speech we've heard tonight, that notion might be gaining added strength. To the Sydney Institute, to Australia Post, the sponsor of this evening, but above all, to Her Excellency, our warm best wishes and friendly thanks.
Well, that's it. Thank you, everybody. Thank you, Bob Carr. Thank you, Nick Greiner. And most importantly, thank you, Governor-General. The bar's open to 10:30. Anything I say is now an anticlimax, but symbolism and ritual, look, it's great. And hearing that from the Governor-General, I thought, was terrific. I'm sure you'll agree. We'll see you next year. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.